examples that USAID was telling Secretary Blinken.
And basically, there's no recourse now, right, because it's done? Or is there anything that the Biden administration could now do differently?
Yeah, the law is not, it was not just a one-time shot. And this is what the U.S. government said, too, in response. They said, we're always assessing the situation. They said that they believed that the situation was improving since after they applied leverage with this. The folks I talked to, both inside of government and in the humanitarian world, said that's not true at all. The situation is as bad as it's ever been, including since the Rafah incursion. But this law does not only have, you know, whenever Blinken addresses Congress to it, it can be applied at any point.
That they could cut off, that the U.S. government could cut off aid to military arms to Israel.
Absolutely. If it assesses that the Israelis are deliberately blocking humanitarian assistance at any point, they can apply this law. That's right.
Brett Murphy, we want to thank you for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for ProPublica. We'll link to your new article, Israel Deliberately Blocked Humanitarian Aid to Gaza. Two government bodies concluded Antony Blinken rejected them. And this update from the streets of New York. 25 protesters have been arrested outside the United Nations ahead of Prime Minister Netanyahu's arrival to address the UN on Friday. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kbu.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kbu.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Monday, September 30th at 5:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kbu.fm. Please visit our website to verify a meeting is being held.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kbu.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kbu.fm/runningonair.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Good morning. This is Keeping It Real, and I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Our guest today is Sonali Kolhatkar, the beloved host and producer of Rising Up with Sonali on Pacific Radio. Her new book is Rising Up, The Power of Narrative and Pursuing Racial Justice. Sonali, it's such a joy and an honor to have you as a guest on these airwaves. You've been on our airwaves for so many years. Welcome home.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
I have to say that over the years, your show has actually been a key part of our public affairs offerings. I think that's a very fair statement. And so again, thank you for helping. Thank you for being part of our community. So I for all the new people, Sonali, and there are many, can you tell our listeners about your show for a start, Rising Up with Sonali? Why did you first start social justice broadcasting and what brought you to this moment?
Wow, you know, that's a really good question. I actually once gave a TED Talk about this entire question, and the whole point of that TED Talk was how one can create a meaningful life for oneself. And that was basically what I did. I was working as an astronomer at Caltech in the year 2000. 2002. And that's my educational background. I'm a trained astrophysicist. And that's what I thought I would be doing when I was younger. And somewhere along the way, I realized that I didn't want to sit in front of a computer and look up and try to figure out what's happening in the world beyond our Earth. I wanted to focus on the issues that we struggle with every day on this planet. And I got more and more interested in social justice. I was getting involved with what was happening in Afghanistan because I had started an organization with some Afghan women, feminists. And then, of course, we know what had happened on 9/11. I was very active with them. And eventually I quit my position and I wanted to do something that involved being able to use my educational privilege, influence people. And someone suggested that I should try out for a radio position on KPFK, my local community Pacifica radio station in Los Angeles, where I live. And I tried out, they liked me, and I stayed. And initially I was hosting a show called The Morning Show. Eventually that it turned that into a morning drive time program called Uprising. Years later, we changed the name to Rising Up with Sonali, and I started televising the show also on Free Speech TV. And that's, so it was a daily program for many years up until 2021, when I finally, after 19 years, left KPFK to pursue a writing career, but I couldn't let go of radio completely. So I continued doing Rising Up with Sonali as a weekly program while I took on a job as racial justice and civil liberties editor at Yes Magazine, where I'm very happy. I still am there today. And and Yes Magazine has allowed me to continue to host Rising Up as part of my work. And, you know, in the next few months, I'm excited we're going to actually officially converted into a Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. So that was my journey to being a broadcast journalist, and now also a print journalist with a book.
I want to follow up with kind of a complicated and strange question. We, as a nation, I want to say just in generally, we kind of hate ourselves. We kind of hate each other. Like, the divisiveness of this country is headline news every day. I want to ask you, when I listen to you and I listen to your show, I don't get that sense. Who do you think we are? Who are we as a nation?
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that you don't get that sense from listening to the show, because that is my goal. Because when we feed ourselves a steady diet of either right-wing media or a lot of corporate media, and unfortunately even a little bit of media on the left, we tend to get either demoralized, polarized, feeling like the world is falling apart, and that tends to feed our apathy, it tends to feed our cynicism, a sense of hopelessness. And one of the reasons why I actually started working at Yes Magazine was because it's a solutions journalism outlet. And it turns out that, you know, our media, our corporate media machine's goal is to make a lot of money by scaring us into thinking that nothing good is happening, and hopefully we'll keep coming back to find out the next bad thing that's happening and keep making some money. The right wing media, the right wing media's goal is to feed a politics of fear,
yeah,
especially among white conservatives, to make you think that everybody is out, people of color are going to come and take what's rightfully yours, and so you have to keep listening because we're going to tell you who to back and who's going to come and save you. That's their agenda. And it turns out that, first of all, social justice issues are very popular because social justice, everybody wins in a world built on social justice. So when we get the chance to explain them to people, they're very popular. And it turns out that a lot of people are implementing social justice policies in local ways and in spaces that aren't getting covered all over the country and all over the world. And when we highlight those, not only do we give people ideas about what they could do in their own community to make a difference, we also undo that sense of cynicism and hopelessness that many of us struggle with, and hopefully make us realize that things are not as bad as we think they are. And I don't want to sound pie in the sky, like I'm putting a positive spin on bad news. Absolutely, there are so many very serious issues in our world and that are plaguing us every day, and we have to be on our guard. We have to fight back against them. But we also have to remind ourselves there are people that are doing amazing things every single day.
Everywhere. I swear, I see that too. Yeah.
Everywhere. We just have to look for it, highlight it, cover it, and uplift it, and multiply it, because it is popular. It is popular to have healthcare for all. It is popular to not have people die at the hands of police. It is, you know, those things are really beautiful, popular things.
And now I have to follow up. You mentioned the term solutions journalism. It's a very specific term. Can you define that for our listeners today?
Solutions journalism is that, you know, we tend to know that there are things that are bad with the planet, with our society. And so our journalists are trained to focus on, here's the bad thing that happened, here's how that bad thing happened, here's what one person has to say about this bad thing, here's what another person has to say about this bad thing, end of story. And solutions journalism says, here's an amazing thing that's happening that people are doing to solve this bad thing in the community. And that's the first focus. And it goes in depth into that. Somewhere along the way, you might get a few details about, as everybody knows, here's the terrible things that are happening. You know, maybe we throw some links into to reports of the exploitation, the abuse, the corruption. But we focus the majority of the story on how people are fixing the issue. And we dig into it. What are the obstacles they're facing? Where are the holes? What's missing? What's the future? What's the next step for them to improve the solution that they're implementing? And the entire story focuses on how they're solving a problem in their society. This is not, and this is becoming a more popular front in our journalism now. AP has a solutions journalism project. Yes Magazine has been doing this for 25 years plus. And so I'm so excited now that people are realizing that really the goal of our media system should be to shine a light on injustice and also on how people are fomenting justice. Both are important.
If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and we're talking live with Sonali Kolhatkar. She brings her new book to Portland next Monday. Let's talk about the book. First, Sonali, can you define the word narrative and explain why it's key in social justice?
That is such a great question. So the subtitle of my book is The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice. Now, I define narrative as intentional storytelling. Now, that intention may be front and center of one's mind when one is telling a story, or it may be built into the assumptions that one holds when one is telling a story. Regardless, one's story has impact, right? So if you're listening to, or if you're watching, say, a Hollywood film about a particular issue, the way in which that story is told really includes the biases of the storyteller, the objectives of the storyteller. And so that, in my mind, is what narrative is. And as a journalist who's now been working for 20 plus years in social justice journalism, I see all around me built-in narratives into the stories that are told, particularly about people of color in our mass media and in pop culture and Hollywood. And many of those stories are destructive, and I, you know, sort of teach the reader how to identify them in my book. And I also see that there are people of color who are infiltrating these mass media industries and changing narratives and countering racist stereotypes and racist storytelling with racial justice storytelling that centers the humanity of people of color. And I think that that's so important because narrative shapes our culture. Our culture shapes everything we do, how we vote, how we treat one another in public, in private, how we view injustices against each other. And if we're not addressing how narratives are shaped, we're not going to be able to achieve justice. And so that's why I focus on it.
It cracks me up because, like, I hear so many, I've been a journalist my entire life. I've been a journalist more than 40 years, actually, since I was a child. And I all my life, I've heard people say, it's objective. It's not objective. It's got to be objective. What I love about narrative is that it draws a circle around the fact that we all have a perspective and our perspectives are valid. And that's the actual point. I love that. And the other point, and you touched on this, is that
the power of narrative journalism and storytelling doesn't stay in a literary bucket. It gets up and walks around all of society. Policy issues, how your local government has worked, how the federal government works, narrative, the power of narrative, and watching the January 6th hearings, like the January 6th trials play out. There's a lot of narrative in there, man. Fascinating. And as you're talking to and talking about social justice, I have to share, like, my favorite nonprofit news project anywhere is called El Tímpano. I will never stop talking about it, ever. It's based in Oakland. You may have heard of it. At El Tímpano, what they did was they started out before the pandemic. And when the pandemic started, they had events where they just invited people to talk about what was impacting them. And they did invite people too. And I believe it was all outdoor spaces. And a key, as you're talking about narrative, a key of this project is a microphone that actually got an artist to create a special microphone that looks like an eardrum. El Tímpano is your eardrum. So they collected the narratives of people in Spanish and in Mixteca, right? And then they used that and they reported on the stories, anecdotes, and narratives that they collected. Just now, they're going to expand it to the mom language. The language from, I want to say it's an indigenous language from Guatemala or Mexico. They're expanding their reportage to include people whose narratives are literally almost never listened to because they don't have a connection to something like media. Anyone who's listening now, El Tímpano, I really want you to just find them, follow what they do. And all they do is ask people what they think is important and then report on that. I just love it. Never get tired of it.
That sounds amazing. And, you know, that's the kind of project that anybody can engage in and be participating in. There are so many, many forms of narrative building and narrative creation. I didn't even touch on in my book how, you know, things like stand-up comedy is a narrative work. So, songwriting and visual art. All of these put forward narratives. The visual art done by people of color is generally very different from the visual art done by, for example, people of European descent. It's different because it tells different stories. And you know, the project you're describing is exactly that. And for too long, our stories have been suppressed and disproportionately, you know, kept aside and pushed aside, and that leads to dehumanization, right? When we are only told and seen through the lens of one community, then we are reduced to two-dimensional beings. We are dehumanized. It becomes easier to tolerate injustices against us. So that is why I think it's so, so important for us to pay attention to how narratives are built, particularly when we talk about racial justice.
I was going to add to that. You yourself are a visual artist, too. You're sort of a Renaissance woman. I don't want to throw a bunch of European words at you. You're a visual artist, too. And I do personally believe that visual art is part of journalism. I mean, I'm a journalist. It's part of media. It's a key part. Even if you're a reporter and even if you're putting out Yes Magazine, you've got to have art to go with the words because it's part of the message. What, I mean, now this is a real rabbit hole, but I'm fascinated by it. What are the aspects of visual art that impact narrative? Do you understand what I'm saying? Or what is the relationship there?
Well, you know, luckily we have these amazing experts at Yes Magazine whose entire job it is to illustrate the stories that I write.
Because that's why that's how important it is. How does it work? I mean, you know,
we have an art director, and I can't, you know, kind of begin to explain what her considerations are. But the idea is that you really want to evoke a visual that draws the reader in, you know, for when you're accompanying the written word, that pulls the reader in to think about it has to really capture the gist of the story in a small panel, in a square that fits below the headline. In terms of my visual art, and I'm glad you said that journalists really are aligned with visual art, at the Los Angeles Press Club, where I'm based in LA, the Los Angeles Press Club has been offering art lessons for journalists because they see art therapy as really key for journalists who are dealing with covering the world every single day. It can be a traumatizing experience, especially if we're doing conventional journalism where we're not really focusing on solutions, we're only focusing on the terrible things happening. It can be a demoralizing and traumatizing thing. And so that was, for me, where art has come in often. I use it as therapy and therapeutic processing of the world. Whatever's going through my head kind of pours out via the paintbrush onto the canvas. And I think that's something that a lot of artists who are either amateur artists to professional artists can relate to. The art just comes out. It's your subconscious mind translating onto a canvas, and that's storytelling. It is absolutely storytelling. And, I certainly wouldn't enter my visual art into any journalism contest, but I do enter it into art. I do enter it into art contests.
I think it looks charming. The piece I want to add to that I think is remarkable, and you just said, you're talking about art therapy. People that work in media, when we are conduits for information, it can be absolutely traumatizing, for real. And anyone can imagine that. Media itself can be traumatizing, even when we think we're just watching a cartoon, right? For everyone. But what strikes me, I went to journalism school, and I'm going to be real with you, I do not recommend it. I think have a life and be a journalist. You do not need a master's degree or a PhD, although wonderful friends of mine are getting them, and I love them, and I'm excited to see what they're going to do with their career. But when I went to journalism school, I was taught who, what, when, where, how, and why, and don't glom on to a cause. And basically, I feel like we were made to be afraid of emotional reality and emotional impact. The people that went into television sort of were trained to key in on the emotional conflict issues and then blow them up. But how do you feel, right? But in the newspaper, where that's what I went to. I don't even need to get into where I went. But I mean, I feel like as a working journalist, I had to unlearn that. And what I love about the idea of art, and now I've met millions of the younger generations of journalists all had to do their own art. And, the older generations were the ones who let the graphic designer do it, right? But there's an emotional reality to almost every news story. And, how do we depict that? And I feel like the art, the photos, that's a way to do it. And, I mean,
it's absolutely, yeah.
Without being like a TV station. That sounded hard. And now you're doing television. You're doing television. I want to talk about that, but not quite yet. We're still going over your book and the power of narrative, and I want to stay here for a few minutes. One of the things that struck me, I wasn't able to get a copy of your book, so I'm gonna get it and I'm gonna read it. But I haven't had the privilege, the pleasure of reading it yet. But when you're talking, if I understand the major point, it's that you're saying when we bring more journalists in with different backgrounds, journalists of color, the reporting changes because there's actually, I'm just going to say, there's more information. There's more analysis of the information with integrity and experiential knowledge when you bring more people of color into the newsroom. And one of the things that really, to me, the biggest story just in my personal lifetime that is impacted by this was the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, it started with a hashtag. And I've spent my whole life in newsrooms, and I've heard this a million times. Decision makers of all kinds argued for literally about 400 years that Black people specifically are arrested and aggressed more by law enforcement in the United States because they are more lawless. That's what people used to say. But the Black Lives Matter hashtag showed that was a lie, like one of the biggest lies in our society. And I don't even ever hear people say that anymore, except overt racists. And we have enough of those. But I mean, can we think of some more examples of that where the perspective, the narratives, specifically of people of color, were able to be changed society-wide? Are there some more examples of that? My wonderful colleague, Ender Black, who's the public affairs director, he's here in the room today.
He's engineering the board. And he tossed out a couple of cool examples that had to do with natural sciences, I think. Can you think of some more?
Yeah, I mean, that is a good question, right? So when we look at how our journalism is shaped, it was considered anathema to point out even racial bias, right? For a long time, our newspapers didn't want to point out things that were racist or people that were racist, because even pointing out racial injustice seemed like a bias to them. I mean, this was what would blow my mind. As an independent journalist, for years, it was very clear that when Black people said they were stopped by police unjustly, we believed them, because really, why would they make it up? And so I've been covering police brutality protests for years. So when the three founders of the Black Lives Matter movement, Patrice Cullors, Opal Tometi, and Alicia Garza, coined that slogan, it made perfect sense to me and my listeners, because what they were saying was that Black lives need to matter since they have not. And what corporate media readers and creators heard when they heard that slogan was, are Black people asking for special treatment? Because in their pages, they'd created this assumption, built this idea that everybody is treated equally because we now live in some kind of post-racial world. And so it was jarring for them and their readers. And it had to, you know, it took the murder of a Black man on video in excruciating, savage detail to convince the rest of the country that what Black folks were saying was true. And what I point out in the book, which I think is really critical, is that social media made a big difference. Darnella Frazier, the young Black woman who filmed George Floyd's murder, didn't wait for the New York Times to contact her for a comment. She went straight to Twitter and social media, and she posted the video, and she made it very clear. She said they killed him right here in front of Cup Foods, no type of sympathy. And she had these broken heart emojis, which indicated how she was feeling in just emojis. And then she just labeled her post hashtag police brutality. She framed the incident so that nobody else could frame it in any other way, because it used to be that our newspapers would go to the police report and they would see what the police said about the police murders and they would frame the story. And then somewhere along the way, they might talk to witnesses, and over, you know, several weeks, they would build a narrative that the person who was killed deserved to die, right. Not, you know, in using many more words than that. And with George Floyd's murder and how Darnella Frazier presented it, everything changed. And, you know, for example, you're asking what are some other examples of that? Look at Donald Trump, right? I point out in my book that in 2015, he literally told America that he was a racist. In his inaugural, in the speech where he announced his candidacy, he said Mexicans are rapists, some I assume are okay. I mean, he literally just straight up said, I'm a racist, elect me, I will be your white supremacist president, right? What did the Washington Post and NPR and all of these outlets do? Washington Post had a detailed fact-checking about, oh, it turns out, actually, that no, Mexicans are not disproportionately rapists. I mean, really? Okay, fine, I'm all for fact-checking. Do your fact-checking, but call a spade, and nowhere in that coverage did they say Donald Trump inaugurated his candidacy with racist statements. They were so afraid of saying that. And they waited until 2018 when he tweeted about the squad, about AOC and Ilhan Omar, and made a comment that was something to the effect of, why don't they go back to where they came from and solve the problems in their own countries? And then NPR and the Washington Post and the New York Times had, you know, internal discussions, deep internal discussions, and they were so proud of the fact that they had whole meetings to decide whether or not they should call Donald Trump a racist, and hallelujah, they decided it was okay to call him a racist. At that point, 2 years into his presidency, was it okay? That was when they decided it was okay to call him a racist. And you know that if our newsrooms had been racially representative right from the start, it wouldn't have taken them 2 years to make that decision, to call a racist a racist. And look what the country wrought. Look what we are all dealing with today, right? As a result, in part, of that sort of coverage.
If you just tuned in, This is Keeping It Real. I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and we're live on the phone with Sonali Kolhatkar. I have to walk back to Darnella Frazier for courageously recording the murder of George Floyd, a video that spurred protests against police brutality around the world, highlighting the crucial role of citizens in journalists' quest for truth and justice. She was given a special Pulitzer Prize for that. And in a way, that's the Pulitzer Foundation making itself relevant. No offense to them. No offense to anybody. But that is them making themselves relevant. But
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I point out exactly that in my book, that they gave her this prize. And, you know, she was one of the lesser, at that point, lesser known members of Black Twitter. And I have a whole section in my book on Black Twitter and how Black Twitter changed, you know, subverted news coverage. If the media wasn't going to cover issues affecting the Black community justly, Black folks would do it themselves. And of course, now they're having to pivot to TikTok and wherever else because of Elon Musk. But this is, you know, it's so crucial that we had Black Twitter uplift and amplify and really shame the corporate media when it came to coverage that was important for their community and for racial justice as a whole. And that's so important.
Sonali, is there an example like this that has not rolled out yet that you wish would move forward in the news? Is there some really burning issue that we need to be on now?
Yeah, I mean, you're just staying on the issue of Black Lives Matter, radical, and all the same old arguments were trotted out against defund the police as were trotted out against Black Lives Matter a few years earlier. You had Joe Biden running on a platform of, you know, pro-police platform, because he wanted to make it very clear that when he said Black Lives Matter, he certainly didn't mean defund the police. Well, guess what? It turns out that defund the police is the only way that you can really absolutely ensure that Black Lives Matter, because that three-word phrase has a whole lot of other things behind it. And I really wish that the corporate media would understand that once more they are dropping the ball, once more they're going to be late to the game. And it's already happening, thankfully, you know, in my work in Yes Journal, Yes Magazine. I'm covering how we've elected an abolitionist, a police abolitionist, to our city council here in Los Angeles, Ulysses Hernandez, who helped to write Measure J, a ballot measure that moved money out of policing and into social services. And I'm so excited about the fact that very recently, this week I believe it was, that the city council, because now we have progressive people elected to it, approved a pilot program to have a non-police people who are going to be involved in traffic stops. Traffic stops are one of the most dangerous places, you know, dangerous kind of interactions between police and people of color. And it can feel very random and terrifying. And so they're taking armed police out of the equation and studying it in a pilot program. That is happening here in Los Angeles. So I am really hoping that the corporate media doesn't, just really get their act together on the defund the police movement and makes it clear that defund the police doesn't mean we are all unsafe and at the mercy of criminals and hoodlums. What does defund the police mean? Do your research, do it correctly. Point out that police, Uvalde, Texas, showed us police don't keep us safe. When our babies are being shot by mad gunmen, police are out terrified of going in and confronting them with their guns, because they don't keep us safe. They're there to keep people of color in line. They owe their origins to the slave patrols and slave catchers. That's where policing originates. And I also point out how Hollywood, and I have a whole chapter in my book on propaganda, how Hollywood, so-called liberal Hollywood, and I'm in LA, so I know a lot of these people who write scripts for television. They are our liberal Hollywood screenwriters, who are now striking right now, and I'm in solidarity with them, have constantly put forward this idea that police are what keep us safe. They write pro-police storylines over and over and over again, because their interactions, white people's interactions with police, are very different from the interactions of people of color with police. So white writers write what they know, which is police are, you know, doing good in society, keeping us safe. And they keep putting out this myth in our TV shows, in our movies, that helps perpetuate this false notion of policing as something that keeps us safe. So Hollywood needs to change, corporate media needs to change, and we need to understand what defund the police means. That's the new front, in my opinion.
If you just tuned in, we are live on the phone with Sonali Kulhotkar. It's interesting, Sonali, because I'm an information hoarder. I'm just going to put that out. I get five or six newspapers, and I wait until they're a dollar for 6 months, for real. And so I currently read the Boston Globe. The Houston Chronicle is a great little paper. I love the Los Angeles Times, and I know I get that paper too, and I know it's problematic, but I'm a major Gustavo Arellano fan. Always have been.
I love him.
If you're listening right now, you've never heard Gustavo Arellano. Most people first heard of him because he invented a column called Ask a Mexican, maybe 15, 20 years ago. He's an incredible thinker. And I first really kind of met him online when he was the editor of the Orange County Register. And so,
yes.
So now you're talking about all these things about corporate media. The most remarkable thing to know, I think personally, about corporate media right now is that it's collapsing. It's on the run. It doesn't know what's going on, right? So, and by the way, I live in Oregon. The Oregonian just announced that it really, really, truly is never going to be a daily paper again, and they're only going to publish paper editions a couple times a week. I guess they were publishing every day and sending it to the store, but now they're not doing that anymore. That is Advanced Local. It is run from the East Coast. But we're talking about, okay, Gustavo Arellano. So bringing more reporters of color, editors of color, staff of color into the news space. There was a terrible, terrible scandal in Los Angeles to do with the city council. And I think it's possible that part of the reason why there's more progressive people now is that a handful of people actually were thrown out because of a recording that was made of four people speaking. And it was in Spanish, right? It was a labor union leader. And I feel as if it was three members of the city council at Los Angeles. And it was painful. It was awful. But the only reason it really got covered was because the Los Angeles Times had Spanish speaking reporters in the newsroom. They won a Pulitzer for that story their coverage of that. And then the owner turned around and eliminated some significant percentage of the news department, of the editorial department. So they won a Pulitzer, and then there was a mass layoff literally like 3 days later, 72 hours later or so. I mean, when I look, the mainstream media itself is collapsing, has probably been in a position of collapse for a long time, with the exception of some of these, like, who is that horrible? Rupert Murdoch. I almost said something that I shouldn't say on the air. But, okay, this is what I'm getting at. This is a big windup. A lot of people who are media consumers don't completely understand the nature of the collapse of our systems in this country, right? They don't really know. They know what's in front of them, right? But I wrote a book too, like about 4 years ago. It's called Street Journalist: Understand and Report the News in Your Community. And my goal is to let everyone know that you should be a journalist. You don't have to get a master's degree, right? And this is a perfect example of that. I want people to know that we need everyone who has an interest to pick up the tools of journalism and start covering these issues. Because just like Darnella Frazier, you don't have to have a special, you know, certification. And so, Nolly, this is what I want to ask you. Is your book a do-it-yourself book? And what is your goal with that book? What do you want to see people do with the knowledge they get from it?
Yes, it absolutely is. I spend a lot of the book on kind of helping uncover built-in narratives in corporate media, show how independent journalists are pushing back, and then in Hollywood, and then show how new filmmakers of color and independent filmmakers are pushing back. And then I talk about social media and all of the ways in which people who are not journalists or filmmakers or TV showrunners are able to use their power of narrative to push back. I go into the classroom and how educators are using narrative power in how they teach history, and it's extremely effective, which is, of course, why there's a right-wing reactionary backlash to it. But you, you know, don't have to be taking a history class or teaching a history class to be participating. And I end the book with a discussion on a new form. It's actually not a new form. It's a very old form with a new name of how we talk to one another in ways that upend narratives and that actually start helping people cut through the brainwashing, especially that the right-wing media and the corporate media do. And that's called deep canvassing. It's something that People's Action has really been pushing. It's a wonderful grassroots organization. And it's built on the work of social scientists who have studied this way of talking to one another that ends up getting people to agree with one another and realizing each other's viewpoint much more than our standard approach. So a standard approach is when people are disagree with one another, we debate each other. And you know, people may walk away feeling good about having debated one another and having held one's own, but both sides walk away with our heels dug in even harder. I don't really enjoy doing debates like on my show and hosting debates because I don't actually feel that they end up changing anybody's mind. People listening to the debate also dig their heels in. And so what deep canvassing does is that it allows people a way to, it gives them a tool to cut through talking points and to just start seeing each other's humanity. And it involves asking questions of one another and giving answers that depend on one's own personal experience. So say you were somebody who was trying to change a voter's mind about a ballot measure, and this was actually studied in Florida. There was an anti-transgender ballot measure, and people went door to door to try to change their mind, the minds of voters. And instead of saying, how are you going to vote on this? Please vote no on this. They said, this is my name. I want to tell you about my cousin, my sister, my son, my daughter, etc., who is transgender, and if this ballot measure were to pass, they would get more bullied, they would experience this awful thing, you know, tell me about yourself a little bit. And it turned out that worked remarkably well, that when you force people to confront your humanity, it's yourself. Really hard for them to deny your humanity. So deep canvassing, you know, so the book is a handbook in many ways. It helps you uncover narratives that are built into our mass media, and it helps you create and push forward narratives that humanize yourself and your community as well. So I really hope people pick up a copy.
I have never heard that term before, deep canvassing. That's fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it reminds me, I love doing interviews with people like you, because it's like, it's just a big glass bowl of ideas. I just never get tired of it. And you're reminding me of a woman from the East Coast who has spent several years on how to talk with people that you don't agree with. I cannot think of her name. I wish I could have. And her, one of the biggest things that she will say was, that she would say is, ask the person, tell me more. And she actually has done, I'm going to think of her name. She's done writing for journalists about how they can interview people that they don't agree with and how mm-hmm. they can cover conflicts without adding to the conflict or making it worse. I might think of her name. Oh, that is fascinating. I love learning things. If you just tuned in, we're speaking live with Sonali Kolhatkar. Her new book is Rising Up, The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice. Sonali, who is your audience? And is it who you want it to be?
My audience is primarily people of color who are sick and tired of seeing themselves be dehumanized in narratives around us. That's like my first, you know, prized audience, because I really feel that for too long, people of color, you know, we have had to watch movies and TV shows that dehumanize us or that just invisibilize us, decenter anything about us. You know, the people who are forced over and over and over again to have the only choices before us in Hollywood are ones where we're either the you know, sidekick, or not even present in the cast. And it's for people who read the newspapers and who don't see named like theirs on the bylines and who are sick of seeing themselves being demonized in the pages of the newspapers. But it's also for white progressives who want to be part of the solution and not the problem, who want to understand their own biases and start to challenge each other and start to be good allies. And it's also for young people who are so far ahead of the rest of us.
Oh my God, they really are.
They really are. I feel very hopeful. I have two children. One is almost 16, the other one's 10. And they are so forward thinking when it comes to issues of race and gender and sexuality. And you know, it's also for them who are interested in going into journalism. And honestly, it's for people, I think, it's for Americans who are feeling deeply demoralized and fearful that our nation is sliding into fascism, because the ultimate goal of my book is, how do we create and sustain a multiracial democracy? Our nation is going through a very, very, you know, a violent upheaval in many ways. It's roiling with this demographic change. In just a few years, we're going to be a majority minority nation. And this is what's terrifying white conservatives. And it doesn't have to. It can be a beautiful thing, because for too long, communities of color have been oppressed. And now, in the building of a multiracial democracy, how do we do it equitably? How do we lift each other up as we climb? And that is really, and the discussions that I've been having about the book in bookstores has left a lot of people hopeful and excited and engaged. People are very, very interested in knowing, like, how do we in the age of Trump and Rupert Murdoch, you know, is there really hope? And it turns out there is. It turns out that we don't have to feel completely demoralized, because we are growing in numbers and our ideas are popular. So that, you know, it's really for people who are interested in seeing the United States finally live up to its democratic ideals and blossom into a multiracial democracy, because it's happening. It's, you know, trains already left the station. There are more of us than there ever were. And when I say more of us, I mean people of color and progressive whites who are not afraid of people of color.
So, you know,
all Americans will look like my kids, who are half Indian and half white, I hope.
One of the things, speaking as a white person, I have to say, it has always struck me, because I've always been in newsrooms, and like for the first half of my life, I was one of the only female people in an all-white newsroom. And one of the things that strikes me about it is another issue is, like, who is the best and brightest people in our society? Who's most likely to come up with a cure for COVID? Who's most likely to come up with the best system for how to vote? It's like that pool of all white people that are 80 years old that run Congress. Ender and I were talking about that. Those are not the best and brightest people. So this is what I want to ask you, Sonali. It's going to sound weird, but what is everyone's role in the media that we want to see that can help plant the seeds or broadcast the seeds of the society that we want to see? What's everybody's role?
Well, I mean, look at how Congress is changing, right? Even though you're right, it's still dominated and the power is held by elderly, white, wealthy elites. You are seeing growing numbers of people of color enter Congress who were considered utterly unlikely to break through, right? We never thought that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Jamal Bowman would defeat these longtime incumbents. And they're running against fellow Democrats, which I think is really powerful. And so one of the things that we can do, you know, like I remember when Deb Haaland was running for Congress, she's now our Interior Secretary, but she became one of the first two Native American women in Congress. And I interviewed her when she was a candidate. So one of the things that we as journalists can do is start taking seriously the candidacies of people of color, people who have never held a political office, who are going into running for Congress. We have this wonderful candidate in Southern California called, her name is Maybe a Girl, M-A-E-B-E, A, middle initial A, girl. She, if she wins, what would have been Adam Schiff's seat in Congress would become the first transgender, openly transgender, first transgender person in Congress in history. And so I've interviewed her. I take her seriously. Corporate media may not want to interview her, although she did get some coverage in the LA Times. But these are the kinds of people that we should be uplifting and making possible what we are told is impossible, because we are part of the industry that sets narratives, even when we're independent journalists, right? Yeah. We can change things. The other thing that I really encourage, like I was on the picket line last week where writers and actors were striking. I'm in Southern California, so the SAG-AFTRA and the WGA, you know, half of Hollywood is shut down because writers and actors are on strike. So I went with my camera and I interviewed in front of Disney headquarters these picketing actors and writers. And one of the things that I asked the writers in particular was, hey, now that you're really intimately familiar with being on the receiving end of corporate greed, how are you going to fold the narratives of why predatory capitalism is bad for us into the stories that you write for television? And it was interesting, many of them like sort of were surprised even by the question. And, you know, they were like, well, there's so much misinformation. And I'm like, you're part of narrative setting industry. You're complaining about misinformation. Do something about it, because you actually can. Don't be helpless, right? People like Boots Riley, who's amazing show, I'm a Virgo. He made the film Sorry to Bother You. He has shown that you can indeed write stories that are critical of capitalism for mainstream audiences in powerful, entertaining ways. So it can be done. So that was one of the things that I did. And so we all, you know, we can do it. We can and should uplift those things that are being ignored, because we, you know, in whatever way we can, and it will permeate culture. We think that we don't have an impact because we want, you know, we're impatient. We work ourselves to the bone, and then we see only the bad things happening, and then we think that nothing we do matters. Change takes time. Narrative change is a long-term project, 10, 20 years, you know, and we got to keep doing it.
This is just a random thing, and I'm just going to speak this wish into the universe. I know a lot of immigrants from the African continent, and it's totally okay if I cry right now. It's okay to cry. And the African communities in Portland and in Oregon and the Northwest, they were hit so hard by COVID. Like, it hurts me. And I want to speak into the universe. I want someone somewhere to make a Timpano-style project for the immigrants from the African continent who are our neighbors, our family here, and to get their stories of loss, because there's a wonderful organization called the African Women's Health Coalition, and I just love them so much. I want everyone to know that they exist, and I'm so concerned that they cannot move forward effectively with their stuff because they're grieving so hard. So that's I just wanted to speak that into the universe because I love them so much.
I'm assuming you've interviewed them on your show.
My show is new. This is only the second or third month, and I do want to get someone onto the show. I want to be able to approach this topic with respect and not be a clickbaity kind of person. Sonali, you had just mentioned taking your camera to the picket line. There's the most charming video that Ender sent me about you and your production partner to do your television show. I want to say, this is what I want to say. How did you start broadcasting your radio show? But is that really what it is? Tell me about it. Talk about that, and talk about that wonderful woman and what you do.
Yeah. So unfortunately, Anna Bus is no longer working with me because we, although she remains a very close friend of mine. When I was doing a daily show on KPFK and we were televising it, I mean, it was amazing. We made the impossible possible, right? Speaking of doing that, two women, both immigrant, by the way, she's Brazilian, making a 1 hour radio and television daily program between the two of us. Thankfully, we've had digital technology to help, so we got a lot of help in setting it up, and we created this video production setup. I started recording out of my home studio because it was just easier than doing it through KPFK's, you know, made for audio radio studios. That involved too much jerry rigging, so we converted one of the guest room in my house into my TV studio. We set up a little space for Anna, and that's where that video was shot. And you know, she would do live video production, live to tape, while I would sit in the other room with a little, you know, iPad teleprompter in front of a camera, interviewing people. We would do 3 interviews a day, put the whole show together, and send it to Free Speech TV in a video format, and then send it to Pacifica radio stations and affiliates like KABU in audio format every single day. We would upload the website and update it. It was insane. Anyway, eventually, you know, we were like, all right, we can't keep this up forever. We did it for like 5 years.
She's gone on to work in it.
And so, you know, I started at Yes Magazine. She went on to work at KCRW, where she still is, which is a local NPR affiliate here. And I moved all of the video production equipment from her little space into my space. And now I do the whole thing myself. I do 3 interviews a week, so it's a little easier. And I am pulling in my lower thirds on screen with my left hand and using my teleprompter remote control on my right hand while talking to my guest and while they're talking, pulling in B-roll. It can be done. I do it all by myself. 3 videotaped, live-to-tape interviews on Zoom a week, and I put together a whole show and I send it to radio stations and Free Speech TV, and it can be done. You know, it's like necessity is the mother of invention. So
indeed,
I've always worked with low to no budgets, and yeah, you know, I did what I have to do. So that's how I do it.
You are a solopreneur. That's what that's called, a solopreneur. I just want to, we're starting to run out of show, but I do want to take a moment and say, I asked you that because there's so many people listening to us, and they will listen to this show in a podcast format too. And they're going to have young people in their lives. They're going to have old people in their lives. I just want anyone listening to this right now to know that we need you. We don't need Rupert Murdoch. We need real people who have the time, the energy, the capacity to bring skills to this issue of sharing information. And as Sonali talks about narratives, in my mind, in a way, I think of that as perspectives rooted in experiential knowledge. But to me personally, in my life, the strongest message I have for everyone is don't hate the media, become the media, like Jello Biafra said. And I mean, I meet so many people who think they can't do it. And I do think there needs to be a tiny bit of joy in there. If there's not some joy, if there's not joy in what you do, it makes everything so much harder. But Sonali, I mean, what do you think about that? Like, I feel like, yes, you're going to meet a lot of wonderful young people who are bringing innovative ideas about how we live. But how do we grow this flower? This is the flower I want to see flourish. When people, you know, they own it, it's theirs. Like, how do we do that?
Well, joy is so important, right? Centering joy in the things that we do is so important because that's the goal. If we want a socially just world, the goal is that everybody gets joy in their life. And so we have to start centering that in the work that we do now, because that reminds us the ultimate goal that we're fighting for. I really do want to encourage young people, don't be turned off and terrified by what you might think is a huge amount of knowledge required to do this. No. When I started out, I was, you know, in my 20s, and I started out on KPFK knowing very little. I was a consumer of radio broadcasting, so I knew what it needed to sound like, right? I used to listen to Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman. I knew what it sounded like, and I learned on the job, and all I needed was for someone to give me a break, and I got lucky, and someone did give me a break. And if you can find that mentor who's going to give you a break and it's going to help you wedge yourself in through the door and, you know, claw your way into the newsrooms and the executive suites and the writer's rooms or wherever, do it, and don't be afraid. Fight that imposter syndrome. Many of us, especially women and women of color, we struggle with imposter syndrome. Just embody the confidence of a mediocre white man and fake it till you make it, because you will be able to do that. You know, it's taken me so many years to not just get other people to take me seriously, but to start taking myself seriously. And it took me a long time to realize that I was enough.
So, Nolly, that's it for our show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
If you're listening right now, thank you for being here. We've been talking with Sonali Kolhatkar. Her new book is Rising Up, The Power of Narrative in Pursuing Racial Justice.
Find more on her work at SonaliKolhatkar.com. That's KolHatkar, easy as pie. And you can listen to this show again and again. Sonali, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Lisa. It's my pleasure.
And this is KBOO. I'm Lisa Loving. Keeping it real. Stay tuned.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
This is Bird Note. Sculptor and musician Walter Katundu first became enraptured by birds in 2005 when he borrowed a camera from a friend. He went to a park to try photographing hummingbirds when all of a sudden a red-tailed hawk
flew about 4 feet above my head, and I turned around and I started following this hawk all around the park.
Walter named the bird Patch. It had a white patch on the back of its head and kept coming back to the park to look at her. And on one of his visits, he saw the bird on top of a streetlight.
And it turned, looked at me, and then jumped off the streetlight and flew straight toward my head. The bird landed on the ground next to me, about 3 or 4 feet away. And it picked up a caterpillar and ate it. And then it didn't leave. We sat there together on the ground for about a minute until it flew away. And for the next 6 to 7 months, I was at that park 3 to 4 days a week, following this particular red tail. For some reason, it had accepted me as part of the landscape. It would allow me to walk up to it while it was feeding, and when a dog would run by, it would fly away. So I realized I had a really privileged relationship with the wild red-tailed hawk, and I think knowing that it was so special, I kept going back, and I was able to document its transition from a juvenile bird into an adult.
You can hear a longer version of this story and see some of Walter's amazing photos of Patch on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
We want you to join us Saturday, September 28th, from 2 to 5 p.m. for a special live broadcast